Hi, everybody. It's Mike. What you're about to hear is part one of a two-part interview that I did with Harlow Rio Monroe, my guest from Nashua, New Hampshire, on the song Apology. Now, we had quite a conversation, and as you're going to find out, this is a song that was only performed once, only recorded once, and then never appeared again. But it did give us a chance to delve into a whole bunch of different things about Lightfoot and about our relationship with him. So this is part one. You'll be hearing part two in about a month. Thank you.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
I remember everything I've learned about survival. I've walked with fools and kings, and I've even read the Bible. There I came upon some lines giving me direction. Gather not your gold on earth, your kingdom is in heaven. This is Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates the work of Gordon Lightfoot, song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and along with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan from Nashua, New Hampshire, Harlow Rio Monroe. Harlow, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I really am looking forward to this. Your podcasts are really interesting.
Oh, I'm very glad to have you. So how did you first get into Gordon's music?
Well, I was quite young when he was sort of at that peak at the early 70s. I was too young to really grasp it on my own, but my parents had a wide collection of music. And through them, I discovered Gordon Lightfoot. I sort of gravitated towards that kind of music, the storytelling music, if you will. I mean, I was listening to Bobby Gentry and people like that at a very, very young age. And I was somehow, even though I didn't always grasp what specifically things meant, I could feel them, even as a little kid. And I really got that sensation from, say, like Cat Stevens or Don McLean's American Pie.
Sure.
And then Gordon Lightfoot and his ability to tell a story so concisely within 3 minutes. And to have that music that punctuated and acted as a way to help you almost inhale those feelings, those emotions, that they became a part of you. And that sort of was it right there. I loved writing. Even when I was like 4 or 5, I was trying to write. I think hearing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald when I was a little bit older, a few years after it had been released, it suddenly hit me. I was listening to it in my dad's car. And he saw that I was completely focused on this song, and he put it up a little. And that's where I think I kind of came to really understand you could do this. You could write a short story, put it to music, have people captivated, and you could do it, again, using these precise word and types of lines. You know, like the tattletale sound is such a evocative, just two words, and it just brought that whole experience of the Edmund Fitzgerald to life and brought those sailors' stories to life, even as they were dying. It just is so powerful.
Yeah. Songwriters, I think, are lucky people, but they also have the biggest challenge that they have to do this entire expression, whether it's sentiments or something that has a beginning, middle, and end. They have to do that in a matter of 3 minutes or 4 minutes. Not very long. They don't have time to be Steinbeck where they're describing something for seven pages.
Exactly. And I think what you just mentioned about, you know, they don't really have that luxury. Sometimes people don't realize how hard it is because it was Sylvia Tyson, the Canadian folk singer who he was friends with and who also helped with his career, who said that Gordon Lightfoot sweated blood when he was writing words. It wasn't so much the music that he had issues with. It was just this finding the perfect words, what to leave in, what to take out. And it could be just like one word. And he would obsess over it. You know, that whole concept of sweating blood to get things as precise as he could.
Well, he was certainly a perfectionist. And Now that you mention it, I don't know that he ever went wrong with any of his lyrics, and he almost never went wrong with any of his arrangements. So I think it just says a lot about the kind of musician that he was. He wasn't just somebody who would walk into the studio, and if you can't get it in one take, you lose interest and you walk away. I think he really had an enormous work ethic in a way that a lot of rock stars didn't and maybe still don't. What about your experiences seeing him live?
I never was fortunate to see him live. Almost did. My boyfriend at the time got the wrong date for the tickets. We went on the wrong day and missed him completely. But I have plenty of my parents' stories of seeing him at the start of his career in the 60s, all the way to the late 70s was really their time frame. And I would kind of live it through my dad's storytelling about it. He was a wonderful storyteller. And so I could get a good, clear feeling for what they were experiencing. And my mom, it's funny, she was never someone to get a crush on anybody. And she didn't necessarily have a crush on Gordon Lightfoot. But the first time she heard him, my dad looked at her and he's like, uh-oh, you know, there's competition.
Sure, yeah.
It was sweet because they kind of had this little joke going for most of the time that they were married, where he would write out like fake Gordon Lightfoot lyrics, a cutout of him or something, and give it to her. And they were just terrible. So it was through them. And you end up being emotionally connected to your past, to your parents, to your neighborhood, your friends, your family through music. And it's especially with Gordon Lightfoot that this occurred.
I love hearing that bit about how your parents had this presence in their life that I think at least on one level made your dad a little bit insecure, but I'm sure he didn't take it too seriously, you know, to have some sort of infatuation with celebrities is normal, no matter what your gender and no matter who the celebrity is.
Right. And there was a weekend that I was probably about 7 or 8 and my mom wasn't around for the weekend. And I noticed it early on. And Dad, where's mom? And he goes, oh, she went with her friend Jigger and Mitch. They're spending the weekend with Gordon Lightfoot. it was very, very endearing.
Very cool. So today you wanted to talk about Apology, which is from the Sunday Concert album. That album, of course, came out in 1969. Why did you want to talk about it? And is there an anecdote or something personal about what the song means to you?
Yes, on both accounts. Well, the reason I wanted to talk about Apology, it's obviously one of his more obscure or lesser known songs. It only appeared on Sunday Concert, and he never recorded it again after that or played it live.
Right.
What fascinated me about it is that coming out in 1969, it kind of came after some of his, what I would call those cheating songs, where he's out there, he's the guy out on the road, and he's not afraid to fear on 8th Avenue, Long Thin Dawn, The Mountains of Marianne, Marie Christine. These are songs that he did on occasion tell the audience specifics, that these were about specific women who he met at specific times. And I was just thinking, he's a married guy. His wife's at home with 2 babies, basically.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, thank God, that had to be horrible to have to hear sort of that machismo all the time. And yet, Gordon, when he met her, was in the early 60s, 1963, and he was not well known. They kind of met on what I call even ground, where she wasn't a fan going, oh my gosh, it's Gordon Lightfoot. She was from Sweden. She was in Toronto, where he was, and they were living in the same rooming house.
This is Britta we're talking about.
Yes, Britta, his first wife. And he had made a joke that for a while, she was always walking in the opposite direction. And it was kind of a joke. He said, I think I fell in love with the back of her head.
Okay.
But what they did do is they finally did meet up in there. He never went into like quite specifics, but we do know that their first date was at George's Spaghetti House in Yorkville.
No kidding.
And yeah. And what occurred there was that his Brita from Sweden does not speak English well. She moved on her own independently in 1963 as a 25-year-old woman to a place where she did not speak the language in order to learn it. It was called immersive English, and that was an actual visa. So they just sort of hit it off. They kind of had the same sort of independent spirit, and he liked that at the time. And she was also incredibly smart, pragmatic, and willing to not only listen to him, but he was also impressed by the fact that she wasn't afraid to give him direction and advice on certain matters. And that even included breaking up with Terry Whelan from the Two Tones. He'd been trying to break up that duo for almost a year. And she sort of said, well, you've got to be able to do that if you want to move on. So she kind of was giving him direction. And the situation arose that she was only going to be there for 7 months. Her visa was up in 7 months by the time that they had met. And even though you kind of have that time frame, they're both young and they're both fully falling in love with each other. This wasn't one of those starting off rip-roaring romance. It was a friendship. And she was learning to speak English better by having dinner with him every night. So he felt he was contributing while she was contributing. And then when it got down to those last months or so, they had been talking about spending the rest of their lives together. It was one of those, you know, when you're young and you think you found the right person, you are talking about marriage, kids, the future. But their future was going to be up when that visa was up. And sure enough, she left and went back to Sweden without making a big deal about it. She was not overly dramatic. She wasn't like that. In a lot of ways, Swedes are like Canadians. Very much we're about being polite. We're about not making a big fuss. And so that's how she kind of left, because he wasn't, oh, please stay, please stay. That only happened a little bit after she left, when it hit him, because he had the blinders on that somehow she was just magically going to appear again. What he ended up doing was, oh my God, I can't live without this woman. And he ended up quitting the TV show that he was on as a square dancer, Country Hoedown. He hawked some things. He hawked some belongings. He wrapped up a few engagements that he had left. And then he called her repeatedly to just beg her, let's get married. But she wasn't giving any answer. And he actually just took off for Sweden with a one-way ticket, having hawked those things. Got there. And again, we don't have a lot of specifics as to what her reaction was when he was at her front door. But in 2 weeks, they were married at her church, had a horse and buggy type thing, and spent a week in Lillehammer, Norway in April 63. 2 months later, she was pregnant. And that's kind of how it came about, that he's 24, he's married, he's going to be a dad. And you sort of look at how, from that point on, he seemed to want to buck the whole idea of being married at that point. It feels almost as if both of them felt there was no other option to stay together. And you wonder if that visa hadn't have been there, if she'd been able to stay, if they would have just waited much longer and then gotten married. I often wonder if that getting married the way that they had to, if it was the only way. It turned almost into a business type of situation of how do I keep her here.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Have you checked out the Dilettantes? It's a podcast full of smart conversations with interesting Dylan scholars, academics, and fans. Find it at fmpods.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, I just wanted to take a second to tell you about my latest podcast discovery. Fire Breathing Kittens is an actual play one-shot podcast that plays various tabletop role-playing games with a season-long plot. Because there's a beginning and an end to each week's story, you can start at any episode. Yeah, you won't miss a thing. Every week has a different combination of four from the same rotating cast of people. Join fire-breathing kittens as they solve detective mysteries, attempt comedic banter, and enjoy friendship. That's Fire-Breathing Kittens podcast. Check it out. It sounds like the song is really about his relationship with Britta, and that may get to the idea that I was going to a little bit later, which is that the song is called Apology, but the word sorry is never even in the song. But it sounds like what you're saying is that the song is really directed to Britta as a way of him apologizing for not being there, for running around, for doing all those kinds of things. Would you agree with that?
I would agree. And I would say that throughout their relationship. Now, when he puts the song out, she hasn't asked for that divorce. That comes within a year. But it's sort of like he saw the writing on the wall and he couldn't. Like, it was compulsive, this cheating. And it's almost like realizing he has this woman who actually is very good for him. And he had said that in interviews, that Britta always made me feel safe and secure. Even a little bit after the divorce, he's talking about that he still loves her. His parting gift to her for the divorce was beautiful. When you're in a divorce and it drags on for 3 years, most men aren't going to write a song called Beautiful.
You know? No, they're not, particularly after the kind of actions that he had taken, which were very hurtful. I mean, the blame for that divorce really is on him. It's not
and
on
Britta.
And that's
something I wanted to bring up about apology, is that when we get to the next one, which is If You Could Read My Mind, before I even knew about apology, that always struck me as a little trying to spread it out more when maybe that's not necessarily the case. That's just the feeling I always got, that apology, which came out like a year before, is more of a pure, right from the heart. I'm not editing this. This is what is eating me up inside. The guilt and the fact that this incredible person came into my life who shouldn't have, you know, wasn't leading a great life. And yet here's this wonderful woman who comes into my life despite all of that. And she's willing to really ride it out with him because she believes that he'll get through the other side. And he just never does. And it's, again, this failing on his part, almost like he doesn't deserve it, or maybe even resents it a little. Obviously, I don't think he's venerating her as the perfection, but when you think about how long they were married, which was 10 years, she put up with a lot.
Oh, goodness, yes. Even if he hadn't had the drinking and the womanizing and possibly the physical abuse, just the fact that he wasn't there is amazing. I mean, I think about people who are married to athletes, professional athletes who have to travel 300 days a year or are never home, and the kind of strain that puts on a parental relationship, or the kind of strain that would put on a marriage. And those people who can go through it and come out on the other end and say, I'll be waiting here, my hat is off to them. But I think, honestly, most people can't deal with that, because you don't marry someone with the idea that you're going to be spending 11 months out of the year away from each other. I mean, you marry because you want to be together. And Britta may have understood what was going to happen, but certainly didn't sign on for the level of pain that she was going to be experiencing. You had said that there was an anecdote from your own life that ties into the song. Tell us about that.
Well, when I was 18, 19, I fell in love with somebody. He fell in love with me. It was just something where it just felt perfect in the way that we fit together. And he was an artist. And I didn't really grasp that. He had women around him all the time, and he made a lot of mistakes. And I kind of felt that he could go out and do all kinds of things and come back. And I was expected to always just be there, holding down the fort and taking care of the non-artistic stuff, because I was a musician and an artist as well. And somehow the relationship just sort of twisted into that, where we weren't equals anymore. You know, he got into some issues with chemical abuse, and I had to walk away from it. But he started to send me these letters, and they were very much in that vein of, if I could just have you back into my life, I've worked so hard, just even if to be friends with you again, that would mean all the world to me. He wrote a batch of these letters, and you know, he said, I compare you to a flower that's really pretty. You start to look at it, and instead of admiring it, you start to tear away at the petals to see what it's made of. Sort of the same concept in a nutshell of what I felt when I heard apology, because I could sense it what he was saying to her in the song was something I had experienced. Mm-hmm. And I still have a couple of those letters. But it also struck me that he dropped everything to go and get her. You know, you might say maybe it's obsession. I'm not sure. But he was willing to risk a career to get Rita back. And I think that's really powerful. So then it becomes more confusing as to all of the cheating and the other things that you said, because she herself, in a very short interview in 1988, mentioned it was dark without her going too much into it. You know, there was a lot going on, more than what the public knew. But the interesting thing is, she said at the end of it, "But I still love him." And he, throughout his career, would write more songs for her. You know, he wrote Song for Winter's Night, Daydreaming About Missing Her. Of course, Beautiful. And I'll just throw out Spanish Moss, which is also written in tribute to her. And the way that he compares her to nature, again, is another lovely way that he writes, is almost as if he's a transcendentalist. That love that they had, despite all of the stuff, it seemed to remain till the day that she passed away, because he never had a bad word to say about her. And even though he would say, "I don't want to talk about my private life," every once in a while, he would bring her up and mention that he had hurt her. And it was very specific to her. She was this wonderful woman who didn't deserve what he had put her through. And that, in fact, If You Could Read My Mind was not one of his favorite songs to sing anymore towards the end of his life, because it just hurt to know that he had hurt her so badly.
Well, yeah, besides just the fact that he'd probably sung it 10,000 times. I think for me, obviously, I didn't have the same kind of resonance with it that you did. But to me, it's a very deep song. It's philosophical. It's reflective. It's yearning, because you can tell that he misses the woman that we know now to be Britta. And it has an absolutely beautiful chord progression.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost a trademark he has. You know, it's a Gordon Lightfoot progression.
Many times. Yeah. Many times. And this is one where he's using major seventh chords in a way that he doesn't use a whole lot. But, you know, he does use them very tastefully in this. Now, what would be the ultimate setting for you to listen to this? Would it be while you're moving? Will it be while you're sitting still? Would it be while you're doing something? Would you need to just sit and listen to it and focus completely on it? What would be the ultimate listening experience for Harlow and this song?
Me and a bottle of wine. Looking back on the old days. No, I'm kidding. I try not to listen to it when I'm feeling a little down, because I'm very much impacted by words. I go past sort of that was sad, or that. Yeah, I can feel it in my gut. So almost a song that I avoid listening to if it's dark and gloomy, because it just seems to add to it. And I don't necessarily want to feel that. And Gordon had said that when he wrote songs, he's not necessarily writing it so that your ear is to every single word. He tried to write songs where you could either listen to them in the background or listen to them exactly as I said, word for word, getting really into it. Music was for everyone. He wasn't snobby about that. Background music is fine. Listening to my words is also fine.
I think you're right. And I think he did that so well that you can listen to him in either circumstance. I think for me, in as much as this was only performed once, this is the only performance of this song ever. Mm-hmm. I take myself to that concert hall, that particular evening where he's playing. And that's where I sit myself, you know, because that's the only way that I can really experience this. Not for me, like, okay, well, I need to be driving, or I need to be at home, or I need to
right.
be. The only way I can do it is to sort of put myself in that concert hall for enough time to experience that. I haven't been there yet.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two. One minute, you're a teacher preparing for the new school year. The next, you're transported to a fantastical realm shrouded in forgotten magic. The creatures around you think you're a long-vanished mage. You have no technology. You have no memory of how you got here, and no idea how to get home. All you have is misplaced magic. Haladar, the Last Surveyor, is the new fantasy novel by acclaimed author Rob Perrier. Available now on Amazon.com and RobPerrier.com.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
So we've talked about the direction of the song. We've talked about who it was written for. We've talked about why it was written. Nicholas Jennings doesn't talk very much about the specific circumstances of how the song got written. And I couldn't find anything online about the specifics. And I don't think Gordon ever came out and went on record about that. So do you have an angle on, you know, where, when, what the immediate stimulus was?
You're right. There's almost nothing about this song. And the fact that he only performed it once kind of also for me maybe tips the hand a little. I think it was incredibly painful. If his voice in that song, while he's singing, the word I've come to use described as anguish. I can't say it was written, you know, in May of 1968. But again, I go back to that sequence of songs before that, when he is, and he's talking to the press, he's talking to his audience about women he's cheated with. He's got the song Marie Christine. He says to an audience, a few weeks ago, I was in London and I met a woman named Marie Christine. She was a French woman. She didn't speak French and I didn't speak English, but that didn't matter. That was the best 5 hours of an afternoon I've ever spent with someone. Oh, and this is to an audience. And I'm thinking, this is a guy who says he doesn't want to talk about his private life. And that's going to get back to someone.
Well, particularly these days, it would be inescapable that if you said something, even if you said it just between an old friend at a Starbucks, it's going to get back to somebody because that's the kind of world we live in now.
I think with this, to me, at least, looking at that starting point of the relationship, it's a friendship. It's on even terms. He respects or even admires her for her independence. He said she was of her own mind. She didn't need him to give her a sense of place or meaning. She was able to be on her own. And I think that was good for him too, catnip, until the marriage. And I think all these old fashioned things started coming at him that, well, now that you're pregnant, you have to stay home. And they're in a little 2-room downstairs apartment that she had found. She's got two, like one who's 18 months and one who's just born. Imagine being stuck like that all the time. She doesn't get out to go on tour. She doesn't get to get away like he does. So her resentment must be growing too. And yet she's doing things like investing their money wisely into better properties so that they're slowly working their way out of that little basement apartment until they've got a triplex that she's bought. She's refurbishing herself. They rent out the two top floors and live at the bottom. So she's put herself fully into his career at the risk of losing her own. She'd wanted to go into be a publicist. She talked about botany, a few other things, but she's given those up. You can imagine the resentment between the two of them growing.
Oh, big time.
Right? He wants her to be open armed when he comes through that door, and she's mad because he gets to go out and have all the fun. For me, I think that the song itself was him realizing at that point, I think he was just an addictive personality. His personality was not that it could cope well with the type of fame he was starting to obtain, even though it wasn't gigantic at the time. He's got woman at him all the time. For him, he's also kind of tied in with Ian Tyson and Ronnie Hawkins, probably not the two people you want your husband hanging around with after shows. You know, it's a good time for them. But I think what's interesting is at some point after all those Cheatin' songs, this song comes about. It was a deliberate release timed against that. Like I said, I don't know exactly when it was written, but it certainly wouldn't have been something written in 1963.
Oh, no.
This is a life lived so far. Even the lyrics within it are so powerful. And like you said, multi-layered. This is a guy who's talking about a relationship that he's very much lived in and knows, even though it hasn't happened yet, he's sort of predicting that he knows he's going to lose it. And that you come to these powerful parts where his ego is completely gone. It's shattered and he's left with nothing. And a lot of ways, it has that timeless, almost troubadour feeling again of the traveling guy and that troubadour time period. But also, I think of it as also sort of a knight's tale as well, with the descriptions of how he's traveling. And in my mind, over road and river and reason kind of fills in to that knight's type of thinking and the troubadour as well, sort of tied in together.
Yeah, it is in one sense the first cousin of Don Quixote, which certainly talks about this person who believes he's been a knight. In point of fact, is just kind of a delusional guy. I don't know that he felt that he was going to lose it, but I think he certainly felt like he didn't deserve it. And given the things he had done and where he was at in 1969, no, he didn't deserve it. So he's cognizant of that, even if he's not quite cognizant of the consequences, which, as we've said, are going to be pretty hard and they're going to come pretty fast.
And the other thing that I don't know that people realize is that he tried to get Brita back multiple times during that 3-year divorce period. And I think that there speaks to the push and pull, which is on one hand, he wants that divorce. And if you could read my mind, you get that feeling he wants that divorce. He wants to move on. And yet at the same time, he's trying to get her back.
It's a classic thing. Who are you going to listen to, the head or the heart? A lot of people have written songs about that conflict. And I think Lightfoot's experience of it was as musically expressed as any of the other major songwriters that we've experienced in our lifetimes. So let's talk about the lyrics for a little bit. I remember everything I've learned about survival. I've walked with fools and kings, and I've even read the Bible. And I wonder what kind of advice he would get from fools, because fools probably wouldn't have good advice. And kings, if we're thinking about kings the way we usually do in the Western world, never had to worry about survival. I mean, they always had their guys around them from the time they were infants. The Bible can certainly give a lot of direction, but I thought it was interesting that he did that. That may have been poetic license, but I thought that that little couplet was an interesting one.
I think that's a good point. I actually didn't think of it that way until you just mentioned that, but you're right. Kings, what do they know? Like you said, they've got a whole court around them from when they're born. They're not going to have advice on this. It's practical or useful.
Well, no. And unless they've been in a war, and if they have been
that's
in a war,
true.
Okay, even that is not going to be, that's great if you're going off to fight, but that's not the setting of this particular song. There I came across some lines giving me direction. Gather not your gold on earth. Your kingdom is in heaven. Now, this is from Matthew chapter 6. It's during the Sermon on the Mount where Christ is admonishing his audience to not go after earthly riches. The other part of that is store up treasures in heaven where moths can't get in when they can't be stolen. You know, he's not going to expound on that a whole lot, but he is saying, this is where my priorities ought to have been. They shouldn't have been on the flesh or the fame or the money or whatever the kinds of things that being a professional musician, especially in the 60s, was going to lead you to.
Good Lord. Yeah. And that's the thing right there is he's choosing the earthly gold.
Or has been up to now. Yeah.
Or has been. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I chose to live instead inside the shell they gave me, till in spite of everything, good fortune came to find me. Now, I had two questions for you. When he's saying the shell they gave me, What does it mean? I'm thinking about maybe his own human body, his own flesh.
Actually, it's in the Bible that it appears where they actually use the word shell. Your soul and your spirit is carried by the shell, the flesh, through your journey on earth. Now, you have to at some point, though, make this decision that the shell, which connects you to earthly desires, shouldn't be the first thing you're focused on. It's about nourishing the soul and the spirit and allowing those to be what leads you, because they're both connected in some way to the eternal, to the heaven, to the good.
So what he's done here is basically confessed that he disregarded the advice that was in the Bible that he read in the last stanza.
Right. It almost feels to me like he's Falstaff, eating and drinking and the earthly fleshes and overindulging.
Yeah, we can juxtapose that against Henry V, who was having to do his duty and was going for something that was much more Spartan, despite the fact that he was the King of England. Till in spite of everything, good fortune came to find me. So maybe this is a quick admission, you know, in spite of everything that I've done, in spite of the fact that I blew off what Christ was saying, good fortune, meaning Britta, came to find me. Is that what he's saying here?
Yes. And it's a bit of, I think, a miracle in his mind. I did all this stuff. And yet somehow this woman she's not tied to the earth the way that I am. She found me. She came to me. It's amazement.
I hate to cite The Sound of Music about anything, but they did say, perhaps I had a wicked childhood. I must have done something good. I tried my best to run away, but I could not avoid the feeling. Soon I was reeling on my feet. So he was afraid of falling for this person, maybe because he'd had his own heart broken in the past. He's 24 years old.
Right.
So he's still a young man. It's possible that he feared being successful, but again, it's the head and the heart. Your head says, no, don't get involved. You don't have the time. This is going to lead you someplace that you're going to have to give a whole lot of your psychic energy when you really need to be out on the stage, out on the road, in the studio, doing all those kinds of things. So he's talking about the experience of falling in love, but he's doing it in kind of a cerebral way.
Exactly. And I think that's another interesting observation that you have. We have to remember, too, that Gordon Lightfoot, in a lot of ways, was very much as crazy as his life could be. When it came to his music, that was the most important thing in his life. And everything for a while got put in the back burner when he was writing. Talk about Spartan, locking himself up in an empty room with just a small wicker writing table and a chair with some cigarettes, some booze, and that's it. And he's going like these 14-hour writing binges, and there's just no room for anybody or anything else. And that's where we get back to, he's sweating blood. I think that's such a powerful image that Sylvia used to describe that. You know, it could be a word like and or the that he'd be obsessing over. We didn't have the kids around, nothing. I think that got him into trouble as well.
Oh, no doubt it did. And the obsessiveness, because it's an economic truth. What's it called? Opportunity cost, because you only have so much time in the day, and what you're spending on this means you don't spend it with your wife and your kids. You've just heard part one of my interview with Harlow Rio Monroe about the song Apology from the Lightfoot album in 1966. Next episode will be featuring my interview with Brittany Jean about the song The Pony Man, and the one after that will be part two of the interview that you've just heard. See you next time.